Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Democratic debate. So as voters are taking stock after part two of the first presidential candidates debate, when another 10 contenders for the White House took the stage in Miami to talk healthcare, immigration, and so much more.
And let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable to discuss. ABC News political director Rick Klein is in Washington. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And Univision News anchor Enrique Acevedo joins us from Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi.
And let's first just get your quick impressions of last night's debate. Enrique, I'll start with you because you're there in Miami where the debate happened. What's your headline from the debate?
Well, I think that the front runner, Joe Biden, has lost that momentum that he had gained in the previous weeks coming into this debate. And I think there are a couple of names that are breaking through this large contingent. Kamala Harris, the case of Julian Castro, Elizabeth Warren, certainly. And I think Mayor Pete Buttigieg also did a good job through the first two debates.
Okay, so probably the biggest moment in the debate was California Senator Kamala Harris taking former Vice President Joe Biden to task for his record on civil rights. Let's listen to that part of that exchange.
Vice President Biden, do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
Well,
I
there
did
was
not
a failure of states to integrate public schools in America. I was part of the second class to integrate Berkeley, California public schools almost two decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Because your city council made that decision. It was a local decision.
So that's where the federal government must step in. That's why we have the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. That's why we need to pass the Equality Act.
Rick, I did not see that coming. What do you make of that exchange?
Truly striking. It seemed like the rest of the room stood still. The other candidates faded into the background as Kamala Harris prosecuted this case against Joe Biden. And what makes it effective is it's not just a one-off attack. She was able to draw on her own experience, her own life experience, and speak to some of the concerns that many in the Democratic Party have right now. And I think it's beyond saying that Vice President Joe Biden may be a closet racist. She explicitly said, I don't think he is racist. No one's saying that. But it's the age of the ideas and the idea that is broadly held in, among many Democrats, that maybe Biden represents a different generation. Maybe he does not represent the future of the party. And maybe those with a different life experience, including the unprecedented diversity on that debate stage, are the people that should be leading things going forward.
Jeremy, this is why diversity matters, because you see it on stage, not just racial diversity or gender, but also generational points of view. And I think that's why these debates have been so useful for the Democratic Party and for voters, because they're seeing that played out on stage.
It was interesting, though, that even a moment like that, and it was a remarkable moment with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, that right after that happened, Rick, there was a tweet that went out from her campaign of her as a young girl, like it was all planned. Are all these one-liners or even these interactions kind of pre-rehearsed and pre-planned by the candidates?
Not all of them, but this one was. Clearly, they knew exactly what they were doing. They had this in the bank. She had indicated that she might talk to the vice president directly if she had the opportunity to do so. She jumped when the conversation came to race. The question wasn't even directed at her. Yes, this was a coordinated attack on a debate stage designed to capture a moment and designed to exploit and expose a perceived weakness in the front-running candidate.
So, gents, Biden has been leading the field according to polls, and Harris wasn't the only one to attack him directly last night. California Representative Eric Swalwell also called on him to pass the torch to a younger generation. How do you think the Harris moment resonated with voters? Enrique, you go first.
Well, I think he was the first to engage with Vice President Biden, and I think he made an incredibly good point in terms of this generational transition that's happening before our eyes in the Democratic Party. The difference between some of the Democratic hopefuls in terms of age, it's decades. So that shows not just in the issues that they care about and that they're passionate about, priorities in their different campaigns, but also in the way they the sensibility they had to touch on those subjects. So I would say also Spanish was the other big winner in this debate. I'm glad to see the candidates celebrating Spanish, using Spanish. I would just add that it doesn't matter what language they do it in, they have to answer the questions, and not all of them did, despite using Spanish.
Yeah, last night Pete Buttigieg spoke a little bit of Spanish, although he didn't speak Norwegian, which I understand he does speak. Rick, what about Biden, though? He didn't seem like, if they were rehearsing these things, he didn't seem like he had many one-liners or things pre-rehearsed for this debate.
And I'll tell you, that may be the most telling critique that emerged in the aftermath, is that he should have seen this coming. His campaign should have seen this coming. It was not an accident. It was not a surprise, given the news of the last week. And yet, he didn't seem to have an effective response. And his response substantively is problematic. He essentially was using a states' rights argument, which, guess what? That's what the segregationists use as well to explain his past opposition for busing, which is on the record. The fact that he even has a position on busing, an issue that hasn't really been in the headlines for 40 years, tells you something. And the fact that he didn't have a response for it now, I think, tells you something else.
So the candidate in second place in the polls before the debate was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, and he returned last night to his calls for a political revolution. Have a listen.
Nothing will change unless we have the guts to take on Wall Street, the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the military-industrial complex, and the fossil fuel industry. If we don't have the guts to take them on, we'll continue to have plans, we'll continue to have talk, and the rich will get richer, and everybody else will be struggling.
Enrique, if we just wound back 4 years, this would have been quite revolutionary in terms of policy for the Democrats. But it sounded like a lot of other candidates had similar policies to Bernie Sanders.
And that's a great point. Credit where credit is due. All of the other candidates are talking about these issues because Bernie brought them up 4 years ago. He was the first one to talk about, you know, universal health care, about canceling student loan debt. Many of the issues that are now a central focus of the 2020 campaign were brought up by Bernie Sanders. But it seems like the other candidates are doing it better and are connecting with their voters better on this issue. So in a way, it's like, I don't know, Snapchat and Instagram. Instagram took stories and they're doing it better.
You know, when we heard moments like that, I have to say, in the back of my mind was Selina Meyer from Veep saying in her political rally, "It's time to finish the unfinished business of 4 years ago." Rick, I mean, there is a lot of, you know, going back, looking back at 2016 in this campaign so far.
That's how President Trump thinks about the campaign as well. Look, I remember Bernie Sanders saying the same things when I covered his race for Senate 15 years or so ago. He said the same things 40 years ago when he ran for mayor of Burlington, Vermont. I think the country got exposed to that 4 years ago. But he isn't changing. And in fact, I think he is talking to what is a pretty big band of followers still. I don't think the fact that he wasn't a major factor in the exchanges last night is likely to change his polling standing. I think most of his supporters are familiar with him and like what he is saying, even if it doesn't change that much.
Okay, we just have to talk about a little bit of other news this week. Important news. Last night, the House of Representatives passed the Senate's version of a $4.6 billion border bill. President Trump called it a great job done by all. But some Democrats were not happy with it. Here's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic representative, speaking on CNN.
We didn't even bother to negotiate. There are House amendments. We could have negotiated it in. We could have conferenced. We could have tried to get amendments in, to get humanitarian provisions put in, to get consequences for facilities that abuse kids in. And instead, what we're doing is that we're immediately going to just saying yes to what got passed out of the Senate.
Enrique, so there's some unhappiness on the Democratic side here, but this bill was passed very quickly right after that terrible picture of a father and daughter drowned in the Rio Grande River trying to come into the United States. Where do you think we are this week on the issue of immigration?
It seems that for a while now, Jeremy, we've had an important consensus around what people should do, what Congress should do to move forward with a comprehensive solution on immigration. It hasn't happened because of a small minority that has hijacked this debate in Congress, especially in the House. But now I think that consensus is just getting diluted with, you know, people like AOC and others in the Democratic Party pushing for more. And I agree with Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. I think there are provisions that were missed. This was a missed opportunity because I think there was urgency from both sides to provide a real solution to what's going on, to this emergency at the border. But you know, what worries me is that on the long run, it seems that we're just getting farther and farther away from the possibility of comprehensive immigration reform. If there was consensus not too long ago, now it seems that we're missing that.
Rick, if it's not children suffering, what is it that's going to push the needle on coming to some kind of consensus with immigration and some solutions?
Well, I think this is a nice little test case of how difficult it is to get things done in immigration. This was widely perceived as Nancy Pelosi caving. You could also call it Nancy Pelosi governing, recognizing the urgency on the border, saying, yes, I'm not going to get everything I want, but we need to make sure that the funds get down there to take care of what is a humanitarian crisis and the tragic scenes. And the fact that she gets clipped from her left by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I get it. I see where the politics are, and just like a Republican will get clipped from the right, but this is how messy this issue is, and it's not going to change.
Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Enrique Acevedo, Univision News anchor. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Today marks 50 years since the Stonewall riots in New York, which helped spark the LGBTQ rights movement. But some of the biggest challenges today are for LGBTQ youth. And one organization devoted to helping them is the Trevor Project. Its executive director, Amit Paley, joins us now. Hi, Amit.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So let's first start with the positive here. All of the things that have happened since Stonewall for the better for LGBTQ people. What do you think are some of the biggest hurdles that LGBTQ people have overcome since Stonewall?
Well, there have been a number of advances for LGBTQ people, both on the legal and rights front, as well as the cultural front. More Americans now say that they know someone who is LGBTQ than ever before. We see representations of LGBTQ people in the media and in the political realm. There have also been a number of advances on the legal front that gay and lesbian and bisexual people have the right to marry someone of the same gender. There have been changes in laws around discrimination that have helped people on the state level in particular. And so there have been growing rights, even as we know there are still a lot of challenges and a lot of work still left to do.
Well, and let's talk about some of the challenges, and especially the ones that your organization, the Trevor Project, focuses on, which is with LGBTQ youth, and specifically suicide. Tell us about the problem, first of all.
Well, LGBTQ young people are more than 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than their peers. We just did a national survey on LGBTQ youth mental health, which found that 39% of LGBTQ youth have seriously considered attempting suicide in the past 12 months, and that amount is even higher for transgender and non-binary youth.
And why do you think that is?
There are a number of different reasons why that's the case, but some of the reasons are the rejection and the discrimination and hateful rhetoric that a lot of LGBTQ young people face every day, both in their communities, sometimes that's from their family or in their schools or their faith communities. There's also, especially in the past few years, been increasing hateful rhetoric happening from the highest levels of the U.S. government and political figures that ends up having an effect because words really do matter, especially with young people.
Well, let's listen to one young person named Rain Grayson, who spoke recently about how the Trevor Project helped when suicide was being considered.
I chose to reach out to the Trevor Project through chat instead of the phone because I couldn't stand the sound of my own voice. And I thought hearing it might drive me straight off the yellow ledge. When someone responded, I didn't let on that I was about to kill myself, but I told them that I felt alone. I logged off fairly quickly, but not before I was told I wasn't alone, which might sound like a cliche until you really do feel like there's no one.
Now, Rainn Grayson is transgender. How do the issues of transgender youth differ from those of lesbians, gay, bisexual, etc.?
Well, there are even worse health outcomes for transgender and non-binary youth than we see for gay, lesbian, and bisexual youth. And part of that is because of the still increased discrimination and hostility and rejection that trans and non-binary people face every day. And there are still a lot of people who do not understand what it means to be non-binary.
And what does it mean to be non-binary?
So there are many people who do not identify as male or female. They might identify as neither, as sometimes both, as sometimes alternating in between. And just some of the many, many types of identities that people under the trans umbrella or that are non-binary might use. They might identify as non-binary. They might identify as gender fluid, as gender queer, as agender. The actual number of labels and descriptions that people are using are very, very long, almost infinite. In fact, in this recent survey that we did, the young people that we surveyed, they had more than 100 different types of gender identities that they used to describe themselves.
Do you think that social media has been helpful or harmful for the LGBTQ youth of this country?
It's been both. People will say things online like, you are an abomination, you are disgusting. They will actually say things to another human being. They will actually say to them, you should go kill yourself because of who you are, because you're a lesbian or because you're trans. But we also can see there are a lot of positive effects as well. For a lot of LGBTQ people, and you heard Rainn talk about this in such an eloquent way, they feel very alone. And so to be able to connect with someone online and see, I feel different, and now this person that I see online is trans, and I now have words and a role model and a person who is living their life in the way that I want to live it, that type of affirmation can be life-saving for so many LGBTQ youth.
You're dealing with individuals who are getting in touch with the Trevor Project because they need help. Is there an overarching solution to try to bring that number down of the amount of people who are considering suicide? Or is it really just a one-by-one solution where you just have to deal with each individual person?
I think it is both. Part of that is making sure that they see affirming messages and that they get a sense that they should be proud of who they are. There's also a lot we need to do to stand up for the rights of all LGBTQ people who've had a lot of rights taken away from them. There are now many, many places in the country where if you're a trans or non-binary young person, you are not allowed in a school to use the restroom that corresponds with your gender identity. That is wrong. That is un-American. That is unjust. And we need to be fighting to stand up for the rights of all young people, especially LGBTQ youth who are most at risk.
That is Amit Paley, who is CEO and executive director of the Trevor Project. That's an advocacy nonprofit that supports LGBTQ youth. And Amit, you say it is what, the world's largest?
We are the world's largest suicide prevention and crisis intervention organization for LGBTQ youth.
Amit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've got more information about the Trevor Project's 24/7 support line at hereandnow.org. Well, as we look back on Stonewall 50 years later, there's a new book about what led up to it. Decades of discrimination and violence against gays, even murder. NPR's Netta Ulaby sat down with the author at the Stonewall Inn in New York.
Lots of gay bars, like the Stonewall Inn, used to be owned by the mob and regularly raided by police back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Safe places where gay men could meet were few and far between. One, says author James Polchin, was the bar at the Hotel Astor here in New York.
So the gay men stood on one side of the bar and the straight patrons on the other side of the bar, right? And the gay men were always policed by the bartenders. Like, don't touch so much. Don't be so obvious. And then when it got too obvious, they were asked to leave.
The Hotel Astor had enough of an outré reputation to inspire a popular song.
But she had to go and lose it at the Astor.
There was nothing cute about an incident in 1948 that Polchin documents in his book. A visiting businessman met an unstable young man at the Astor Bar. who later that night murdered the businessman in his hotel room. At the trial, Polchin says the young man claimed he was the victim.
I was under threat. This guy was going to attack me. The other man came onto me. I had to defend myself. It was an indecent advance. I had to kill him.
Indecent Advances is the name of Polchin's book. It's a history of so-called homosexual panic that lumped gay men with rapists and pedophiles when, quote, indecent advances became an actual defense at a time when just being gay could land you in jail.
Sodomy was a criminal offense, a felony, across 50 states at the time.
Polchin says homosexual panic was at the heart of a 1944 crime story involving a soon-to-be-famous beat poet. The first time Jack Kerouac's name ever appeared in the newspapers, says Polchin, was when he served as a material witness for a close friend who'd killed an older man, part of their sexually fluid circle of artists and writers.
And after stabbing him to death, he pushed the body into the Hudson River, and then went to Kerouac and said, okay, I did this thing. What do I do now? And Kerouac helped him get rid of the knife and get rid of some other evidence.
Then Kerouac helped his friend establish a defense.
That he was strongly heterosexual and that this was him protecting himself.
Back then, male hookups gone wrong were the only time stories about gay life appeared in the press, Polchin says. You had to read between the lines, but sensational articles about the torso killer and the back bay killer traded on the murders of closeted gay men. They amplified a sense of depravity and horror around homosexuality. They even leaked into radio dramas.
I'd like your services tonight for just a few hours. I'm meeting some men. I'm paying them some money.
Murder My Sweet from 1944 is based on a Raymond Chandler detective novel. One character, easily read as gay, gets fatally beaten. It's implied that his homosexuality led to his death. In addition to the real stories about murders he researched, author James Polchin also found instances of men whose families did not press charges against their killers, because doing so would have revealed details that outed the victims as gay.
Those cases, and there are a few of them in the book, really hurt. Because I understand why the family would do that. I understand that they wouldn't want their son to be put in the newspapers as a criminal, as a homosexual. But to read those kinds of cases where the family would let the killers get off with a much lesser plea is really hard.
These victims were easy targets. They often came to New York or other big cities for business and to fleetingly be themselves. Coverage of their murders usually centered on their assailants, James Polchin says. He cared about the men who were killed.
I wanted to go to the hometown papers. I wanted to go to the newspapers where some of the victims grew up, right? And oftentimes they would portray the crime differently because it's their hometown child.
Their stories made Polchin feel a connection, he says, to a time when the legal system routinely failed gay men and their families and the people who loved them. The 50th anniversary of Stonewall should be a celebration, Polchin says, but it's also a time to remember a shocking and heartbreaking past. Netta Ulubi, NPR News, New York.
The G20 summit continues in Japan today. President Trump had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, their first face-to-face since the Mueller report was completed. And tomorrow, Trump is meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping amid trade tensions. Joining us now from Osaka, Japan, is NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
So the clip that's playing on the media here is of President Trump meeting with Vladimir Putin and joking with him, waving his finger at him and saying, don't meddle in the election, ha, ha, ha. What happened there?
You know, Trump has always downplayed the role that Russia played in the 2016 election. He's often questioned the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community that Moscow put its thumb on the scale in an effort to help him. Trump bristles at that idea. He sees it as a challenge to his own legitimacy. And that's why he's always been skittish about really confronting Putin and why he did so in such a joking, non-serious way today. Now that the Mueller investigation is complete, Trump says he's eager to strengthen ties to Moscow, and he argues that good things will come from those ties, meaning more cooperation from Russia in trouble spots like Syria or Venezuela.
still, the idea of the president making a joke about a country meddling in the election when all the intelligence agencies said that that's exactly what they did the last time around probably strikes some people as inappropriate.
A lot of the people behind those investigations weren't laughing.
Yeah. Trump also spoke with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and India's Narendra Modi. What was the tone of those exchanges?
It was actually pretty friendly in contrast to the way Trump had been talking about Japan and India in recent days. Earlier this week, the president was complaining on Twitter about protectionist trade policies in India. He went on television to complain about the defense pact with Japan that he sees as one-sided. But face-to-face, he was much more conciliatory. He flattered Shinzo Abe and Narendra Modi. He spoke confidently about doing trade deals with their two countries, although he offered no details of those. And this is kind of a pattern we've seen with President Trump, where he likes to talk tough at a distance, but he's a lot more restrained when he's up close.
Tomorrow, the president is going to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Will that get us any closer to an end to the trade war or even a trade deal with China?
It depends on what you call closer. You know, there's a good chance the two sides will go back to the bargaining table and resume the talks that broke off last month when the Trump administration accused China of backtracking on commitments. And in exchange, the president is widely expected to put off his threat to impose new tariffs on some $300 billion worth of Chinese imports. But even if the two sides do start negotiating again, there's no guarantee they're actually going to make a deal. This is tough stuff, as the president and his team are finding out. And if it were easy, it would have been done a long time ago.
Scott, is Iran, is Venezuela, are other issues coming up at the G20?
Certainly Iran and Venezuela are on the table. Another interesting thing to watch for on Saturday is the president's meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. It's the first formal meeting between Trump and bin Salman since Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi was killed last year at the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Just as Trump has been reluctant to confront Putin over election interference, he's been reluctant to confront the Saudis over Khashoggi's death. He's basically taken the Crown Prince's denial of responsibility at face value. So that meeting tomorrow will be another one to watch.
That's NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley joining us from the G20 in Osaka, Japan. Scott, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Today, the U.S. women's soccer team takes on France in the quarterfinal of the Women's World Cup. The French host team, Les Bleus, is aiming for their first trophy, the U.S. going for its fourth. We will be following the game, but let's talk about the women on the team and how they got here. Joining me now, Gemma Clark, a British sports journalist and author of Soccer Women, The Icons, Rebels, Stars and Trailblazers, who transformed the beautiful game. She joins me from New York. Gemma, good to see you. I know you're going to be watching the TV very soon, but thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This US team, I mean, they're a remarkable. It's not just one team, but multiple teams over the last few years. What makes them so special?
This is an incredibly special team. They're the best team in the world. And defender Ali Krieger, I think, said they've actually got the best two teams in the world because they have such a formidable squad. This team has really been built by the players in the USA from the 1980s onwards. This team has had to fight for absolutely everything. Historically, to fight for a wage, to fight to be playing in uniforms that weren't handed down from men's teams. And now the players that we have, they're global superstars. You could walk down the street in New York and there's a huge billboard of Alex Morgan, who plays up front for the US.
So let's pick out some of these players. Let's talk about Alex Morgan. Why is she special? What's her backstory?
She's an absolutely formidable player. She's the youngest USA player to score 100 goals. She has been a huge prospect from a very young age. She went and played in Lyon. She's played for the top teams in the world. But she's also got a huge following, and she's been in a movie that was basically about a poster of her coming to life. She's would be compared to the Mia Hamm of this generation.
Got it. Lindsay Horan, tell us about her.
an incredibly important player for the U.S., hugely dominant in midfield and really key to the success of the team right now. She was rested against Spain. She'll be back in today. As a young player, she was told to lose weight by one of her coaches if she wanted to succeed. And so she's really been open about that and fought to show that women of all shapes and sizes can be successful in sports in particular, and that her frame is incredibly important. She's incredibly athletic and a real presence for the USA, both on the pitch and off.
One of the challenges that the Women's World Cup has is the issues about sexism and how women are viewed, and some misogyny in the coverage. So there's always this element where you're not just talking about the sport, but you're also talking about the other issues that go with being a woman athlete. So there aren't very many mothers who are playing in this Women's World Cup. Why do you think that is?
I think it's very difficult to get the support, first and foremost, for women to return to playing after having had a baby. But there are notable examples. The USA has Jessica McDonald, who has returned to playing after having children. Sydney LaRue Dwyer is a US player who just had her second child, but she returned to playing after having a baby. And there are USA players who really paved the way for this, like Joy Fawcett in the 90s. She was the first player to campaign and to ask US soccer to give the players help on the road and have childcare. She told me a story about showing up to a game with her infant daughter. She showed up to the accommodation that had been provided and was told, oh, you can't have a baby here. And so she's there to play and has nowhere to stay. And luckily, a local family took her in. So there, as I said, this team has been built by the players, and the players have paved the way and made it possible for mothers to be players at the top level.
So now Jessica McDonald, who's a forward on the US women's team, her seven-year-old is going to come watch her play over the next couple of days. And there's childcare. FIFA are paying for childcare.
It's incredible. And the efforts that the players who have come before made in order to make that possible, it's everything. And I think it's worth knowing that when you watch the games, that this really has been built by the players themselves. It wasn't built by the federations. The women who first began playing found the discrepancies and campaigned for better conditions, and that continues now with the U.S. women's team taking U.S. soccer to court, which is, it's now in mediation, to ask for equal pay.
Let's talk about one of the big stories that came out of the U.S. Women's World Cup team, and that was from the co-captain, Megan Rapinoe. She had a bit of a tussle with President Trump this week. What do you make of that?
I mean, she's an incredibly vocal advocate for equal rights. She was the first white athlete to kneel during the national anthem in support of Colin Kaepernick. And, you know, those are her values. And many other players on the team support her, and they happen to go against the values of the current administration. And it's fair to say that tussle will continue.
So if you missed it, where were you? But basically, Megan said, I am not going, if we win, I'm not going to the White House. President Trump said, well, maybe you should win before you start deciding where you should go. And then this is how Megan responded to that.
I stand by the comments that I made about not wanting to go to the White House, with the exception of the expletive. My mom will be very upset about that. But I think obviously entering with a lot of passion, considering how much, you know, time and effort and pride we take in the platform that we have, and using it for good and for leaving the game in a better place and hopefully the world in a better place, I don't think that I would want to go, and I would encourage my teammates to think hard about lending that platform or having that co-opted by an administration that doesn't feel the same way and doesn't fight for the same things that we fight for.
Just looking at the history of women soccer players there, Gemma, do you feel that activism going hand in hand with how the sport is played and how the sport is advanced, is there any harm that can come from that tussle there between Megan and President Trump?
No harm at all. This sport is a reflection of what's happening in the world. And this soccer team is a reflection of what's happening to women in this country, and they stand up for what they believe is right. And it's hugely important if we're talking about setting an example beyond the sport for young girls and women. This team is showing them, yes, you can fight for equality and you can stand up and say, I don't believe that just simply because somebody is in power that it necessarily means that you have to kowtow to that. And so I think that she's demonstrating that. And as she said before, to her protest is a form of patriotism, and she's sticking true to the values of America that she believes are right, which is equality and truth and justice.
Beyond the US women's soccer team, there are, according to FIFA, billions of people watching this Women's World Cup. There was a tweet that I found just a few hours ago, and it was a youngster checking in with her dad. And her dad was been watching the Women's World Cup. And this is what he said. There's no diving or falling or faking injuries. It's just about the game. This is wonderful. Look at that save. Gotta go. Game is still on. Hashtag Lionesses. Lionesses is the England women's soccer team there. But I'm just wondering, Jim, are you seeing the women's soccer game internationally being boosted by this current World Cup?
Absolutely. The popularity is just growing. And in England, you know, the games have been broadcast live at the Glastonbury Music Festival. They're on in pubs. There's a huge amount of coverage in the newspapers. They're getting front page stories. There's a lot of support for the England women's team. And certainly here in the US, the US women's team has been incredibly popular for a long time and far more popular than their male counterparts. And you know, still so much rests on their shoulders. I think the bonus structure is still incumbent on their actually winning the tournament. So there's still a way to go, but popularity is increasing, and that's just a fantastic thing for the game and fantastic outcome for the efforts of not only the current players, but all the players that have gone before.
And finally, what do you think will be this legacy of this Women's World Cup 2019?
Gosh, I mean, it remains to be seen. I guess that's going to depend on what happens in the next few games.
You sound like a football commentator, Gemma. It remains to be seen. It's a game of two halves. Who knows what could happen?
Cliche.
Thank you so much, British sports journalist Gemma Clark. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Usually, the word smart is a good thing, but maybe not when it comes to a TV, because Samsung just advised users of its smart TVs to run regular virus scans on the TVs. Didn't have to deal with that in the days of the Sony Trinitron. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so Samsung tweeted that users should run virus scans on their TVs every few weeks. Then it quickly took the tweet down. What's going on?
Okay, so here's the good news. The short answer is that it is highly unlikely your smart TV and your Samsung smart TV, wherever it comes from, is infected with a virus. And the reason for that is kind of twofold. One, there seems to be a pretty low level of evidence here of hackers building viruses for internet-connected televisions in general, mostly because building viruses for phones and computers, et cetera, is way more lucrative still for hackers. Two, most of the people who have been impacted by malware on a smart television are doing more technical things than the average user, like actually browsing the web with the television instead of using it to, you know, like watch your favorite shows. Samsung seems to have put this message out kind of as a reminder to people to make sure they, you know, update their software and do their virus scans. And it's a little complicated from there. Now, the company works with McAfee, the antivirus maker, in order to have this virus scanning software on its televisions. And it's a little bit unclear whether this is really about McAfee wanting kind of access to a bunch of Samsung users and be delivering its service that way, or whether it's about Samsung wanting this antivirus software from McAfee. McAfee provides software for a bunch of Samsung devices. Now, Samsung has put out a statement. They said, "We want to clarify that this was simply a way to educate consumers about one of the features included in our products and was only posted because we believed that consumers would find it informative."
But then people obviously didn't find it informative. They found it scary, and then Samsung had to take it down.
Absolutely. That's right.
Okay. And this is also not the first time that Samsung has gotten into hot water with its smart TV. This is the same company that we found out was listening in on users through the smart TV back in 2015.
That's right. So along with perhaps unnecessarily connecting televisions more and more to the internet, companies like Samsung are using voice recognition software, just like Alexa or Google or any of these other smart speaker companies and software that's already out there. A few years back, Samsung put into their privacy agreement a warning that it would be listening in, and users did not, of course, love this idea. Granted, Jeremy, who among us hasn't yelled into the abyss, where's the frickin' remote, right?
but it never answers. Does it ever answer? Does Alexa ever say, oh, it's right over there?
Yeah. No, that's true. But at least you could control your TV that way, right? You could potentially talk to your TV, depending on the TV, and control it that way, which might be a good thing, especially since there are no buttons on the TV anymore. You know, call me an old man, but I have read George Orwell's 1984. I remember the telescreen used as a propaganda and surveillance device. So I'm personally not a huge fan of just like connecting everything in your home and your living room to the internet. But, you know, consumer options are much more designed to just feed you entertainment.
So if TV makers like Samsung want this internet connection on the TV because they want to be able to subsidize the cost of the TV by selling your streaming data, as you said, and customers want to be connected so that they can watch Netflix and whatever just straight through their TV, what's the solution to this? How do we get to a place where we can feel safe with our smart TVs?
So I think, again, the takeaway here is that you're probably not in any immediate danger of being somehow attacked through your television by hackers. However, as smart TVs become even more common, I think close to 30 million households in the U.S. have smart TVs at this point. This is a bigger concern. If your device manufacturer says update, I do think you should update, right? That's how your device manufacturer protects you from security holes and things like that. But as we have already said, updating software is annoying. So as a user, I think people should think about what they want and do the research when buying the television. Do you want a TV that is, you know, super, super duper connected to the internet and you have to update software all the time? Or is it actually better to at least try and relegate the annoying software update stuff to one of these streaming sticks or external devices that is ultimately cheaper and, for better or for worse, more disposable than that big, beautiful $1,000 flat screen that you put on your wall, right? So I think, at least for the interim, I think one of these external streaming devices is in some ways a better solution for the consumer, and the less bells and whistles in the television for connecting you to the internet and doing all sorts of fancy things that you might not actually need if you just want to watch your shows, maybe the better.
Yeah, I have to say, when I'm shopping for a television, which I haven't done in a long time, but when I am doing that, I want the best picture. I don't really care that much about being connected to the internet, but maybe that's just me. Ben Brock Johnson.
You don't want all those apps? You don't want those apps, Jeremy?
No, I don't. You can get those through, as you said, a Roku stick or an Apple TV or cable or whatever you have.
Absolutely.
You don't need it to be on the TV. Anyway, that's just me.
That's right.
Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here Now. Thank you.
Thank you.
The only smarts I want on my TV, Femi, is
yes,
you
yes,
when
sure.
you're on TV. There, you're my smart TV.
Oh, thank you so much. And you can watch me Monday through Thursday on Al Jazeera.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Femi Okay. It's Here and Now.